And as an organization, we sit in this really weird space where we're a podcast, which has its own community, which we've never been terribly engaged with before, and that is changing. And we're also a publisher in a genre, which has a community, which we're both incredibly engaged in.
We all know the truth. More connects us than separates us. But in times of crisis, the wise build bridges, while the foolish build barriers.
You raise walls, I destroy them. Let's see who prevails.
Just because something works doesn't mean that it cannot be improved.
I say we take off and nuke the entire site from orbit.
It's the only way to be sure.
Allow my sword to join you in the fight against evil.
The world needs us to chase dreams.
We have to dedicate ourselves each and every single day to this fight because I can't do it alone.
You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Taking over audio drama, one genre at a time.
I'm Trishy Mattson.
I'm Jen.
And with us today, we have Alistair and Marguerite, special guests from the Escape Artists family of podcasts. Welcome!
Welcome, guys.
Hello.
Hi there.
So, I have to laugh whenever I see a new article from some newspaper or magazine that has discovered podcasts, but they only laud the big slicks who don't need more publicity. Or they marvel that some podcast has been going on for all of 5 years or something.
And with that in mind, tell us about the long history of the Escape Artists, and specifically kind of how you guys got involved with it and came to take over.
Sure. And just as a moment of solidarity, every single time one of those articles comes up, I become that gif from Deadpool, the fake laugh hiding real pain.
We've literally thought about getting one of those stop the clocks from Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
You know, it has been X day since someone invented podcasting.
Basically, about, Jesus, I think 15 years ago now, yeah, near enough.
Actually, I think it's 15 years this April.
15 years ago this April, Sarah Ely realized that they didn't have anything interesting to listen to on their commute. So they wanted to do something about that. And this was one of those kind of Walt Newton moments where the right technology is in the right place at the right time. So they started Escape Pod, a science fiction short story podcast designed to give people something good to listen to on their commute. And it was lightning in a bottle. It was lightning in a bottle that proceeded to strike three more times.
Yeah.
Across the course of the first 5 or 6 years of the company's existence, Escape Pod expanded to include Pseudopod, which does horror, Podcastle, which does fantasy, and when we took over, we folded in Cast of Wonders, that does YA. And like all truly great creative projects, this thing kind of amalgamated. You know, there was no real structure to it. It was just a thing that suddenly started happening. And I, around a year into Pseudopod's existence, and this is sufficiently long ago now, that I was downloading it on a 56K dial-up modem and could watch the little gray thermometer slowly fill up as the episode downloaded. I heard Mirth say she was thinking about stepping away. And I did something which I never normally do. I volunteered. I literally emailed Ben Phillips and went, I think you should have me as the new co-editor because I'm very good at it. And I think that was the sum total of the email. There was no qualifications. There was no, here is where I've written before. And Ben and Sarah both wrote back to me with, yeah, we've been aware of you for a while. Come aboard. And it's now a job I've held longer than any other job. And I don't just mean digitally. I mean any other job.
It's one of the big reasons that when Sarah decided she finally wanted to step away from EA, Alistair was the only pair of hands she was willing to trust. He was the longest surviving. That's an interesting choice of word when it comes to Pseudopod. longest surviving staff member, and she wanted to entrust it to him. So in 2014, we did kind of the startup thing. We sat down, we put together a 5-year plan. We thought about, okay, let's treat this as ground zero. How would we go about doing it? What would be our goals? What would we want to accomplish? And we're just now coming to the end of that 5-year plan. Mm-hmm. And we're about 90% of what we wanted to accomplish. And it's been really good. It's been a heck of a learning curve.
Oh, yeah. And it mapped onto the traditional 5-year startup plan perfectly. Like 3.75 years in, we both went, oh, God, we're miserable. And there's not as much money as there used to be. What do we do now? And you do the thing every startup does. You power through.
Yeah. And it's basically where we are.
In the time that you've been doing this, how has the story market changed? How has the stories that you've produced changed? You know, how has the audio drama market changed in the past 15 years?
That's all changed a lot. Why don't I take the story market and you take the audio
market? Cool.
Okay. So Sarah started EscapeBot in 2006. And one of the core goals wasn't just bringing short fiction to audio, but it was specifically bringing reprints to audio. Sarah had a really good eye on the market. And at the time, what was starting to happen was there are so many magazines now that if you're an aspiring writer and you're trying to get a sense of what's out there, what a specific publication is interested in, and what a specific editorial taste is, it can get real expensive real fast to be able to follow the traditional wisdom, which is buy several issues and read them. And so Sarah's solution to that problem was, we're going to not only have original fiction, but we're going to concentrate on reprint fiction, because using the distribution method we do, the Creative Commons, we release for free, which means if you go to EscapePod and you look for a story that was released by any other magazine, I can't guarantee you'll find the specific story you're looking for, but you'll find a couple, enough to probably give you enough of a sense of what big points that publication may or may not be interested in. And in fact, there was an article in Locust just this week where I can't remember the author's name off the top of my head, but he mentioned that he was having a difficult time breaking into short stories. And so his solution was to binge listen to 500 episodes of EscapeBot.
Oh my goodness.
Over the course of like 18 months, he apparently listened to the entire EscapePod and Podcastle back catalogs. And he said that gave him just a remarkable sense of what the rules of short fiction were, and a really strong sense of nuance based on where the story was originally published, whether it was an original to EP or Podcastle or an original to another publication.
It's almost like learning a language. In that the more you expose yourself to this stuff, the more you cram it into your brain, the more instinctively you break it down and understand it.
Yeah. So the second point of your question was about how has the short fiction market changed? And the short answer is a lot and none in some ways. So I think this is the first time last year it's demonstratively the first time when EscapePod was the very first audio publication ever nominated in the semi-pro reading category for the Hugo, despite audio fiction being qualified for several years, thanks to some great work by Mary Robin at Kowal with the Hugo nomination committees. But the short fiction market in general is still very oriented towards original publication. Some magazines only publish original fiction. We have never taken that tack. And it's because of that kind of core mission statement that's at the heart of what Sarah started. We really love being as accessible as possible. And part of being accessible is, one, publishing weekly, so there's a lot of content, and two, giving people, listeners specifically, writers, aspiring writers, or just fans, a second bite at the apple, a chance to listen to a story, maybe not when it was originally published, but for free at some point. And for example, one of our favorite like things that Escape Pod does every year or tries to do every year is Hugo Spotlight Month. Well, they will try to reprint and get the reprint rights for nominated stories for the year. So that even if all of those stories as original publications were released in a magazine that you don't have a subscription to, now you're going to have a chance to do it. Even if you're not a voting member of the Hugo, you know, committee, you can have access to the story. You can be part of the community and the buzz that's building around those stories at the time.
And that actually speaks to the expansion in the field as well, because I mean, obviously, that kind of work runs very parallel to the massive explosion in size of the voter packet that's happened across the last 6 or 7 years. Mm. And the acceptance of audio in every level as culturally valid in this field has been glacially slow. Mm. But it's now definitively starting to happen. And with my podcast journalist hat on, I see that especially viscerally, because I have a podcast journalist hat now. There are about five of us. Gavin, who does Podcast Report, Will Williams, Ellie, who works for Bellow Collective. All of them are just, these are people whose newsletters and articles I subscribe to as a matter of course, because every week they'll find a dozen new shows, all in genre. And the particularly interesting thing that speaks to the show we went to a couple of weeks ago is genre has absolutely embraced the full cast audio drama.
Mm-hmm.
There must be hundreds at this point. And the standard of production and writing in them is extraordinary.
Yeah, I think one of the things we've actually suggested for Hugo programming this year is a taxonomy panel and talking about, okay, this is a medium that's existed now for long enough that we're starting to step on each other's creative toes when it comes to vocabulary. Because mm-hmm. what I think of as an audio drama, maybe what someone else thinks of as a radio style production, or what I would consider a straight narration read fiction, but with a sound floor, other people would consider audio drama. And we're getting into this great kind of critical mass where there's been enough experimentation. There's been a couple of kind of solidification points about, okay, there's lots of appeal to true crime narrative style presentation. There's a lot of draw towards female psychologists speaks with subjects about X. I mean, there's like a whole subgenre right there that you can think of. And what's really heartening to us is fiction specifically is starting to play more and more of its, you know, an equal partner in the development of the audio space, because people are realizing it can be as engaging of a way to interact with fiction as interacting with audio drama.
Absolutely.
Well, you've answered one of the questions I was going to ask about growing recognition. Happily, Escape Artists and its contributors have been nominated for numerous awards. One of your stories was up for a Hugo this year, and I saw that you too, Marguerite and Alistair, were recognized as Legends of FantasyCon 2018. But unfortunately, the two awards that I know of that Escape Artists actually did win this year, you ended up deciding that you had to decline them because of, let's see, what did you call it? The systemic failure of care that has taken place with this year's Parsec Awards. I'm sure that was a painful decision, even if it seemed clearly morally right for you. How much weight do you believe that creators should give for what's going on with an awards platform when they think about their interactions with that?
I think that's a conversation that's happening genre-wide. I mean, as we speak right now, and I won't go into details on this because it's a just vast morass of stuff. Tabletop role-playing is having its version of this with a gentleman who has been credibly accused of serial harassment and has been very highly placed in several publishing companies for a very long time. And it comes down to the missing stare effect. It comes, and I think about this an awful lot, because especially in the news cycle that we're in at the moment, it's very, very easy to think that everything is getting exponentially worse all the time. And strange as it sounds, It isn't. Andy Samberg, of all people, actually articulated what the problem is. And it's this. It's always been this bad. It's just now because of our phones we can see it. And the raised awareness of creators and how they comport themselves and of the ecology within which each creative decision exists feels like the entire planet is in a burning dumpster hurtling over a waterfall of effluent. It's not. But what that raised awareness does is puts the onus on us as creators and us as listeners.
And to be honest, as us as, I hate saying this, but established players in a small field. I mean, if someone in a position of privilege does not speak truth to power, then you're complicit. And I think it's a hugely important part of being a responsible member of a community to realize that if you've received an award, and yet there are other people who got stepped on for someone else to receive an award, then none of us won anything, did we?
Exactly.
And we all have to link arms and say, no, this is not an acceptable standard. We can be polite about it. We can be constructive about it. And we don't have to be. We don't have to be either of those things. But we do have to say something. We can't be silent. And saying something this time was saying thank you, but no. I mean, we have a long history with the Parsec Awards. It's a great organization. Murr is one of the founding members. They're kind of one of the only real voices in audio fiction award giving, and that's always been their focus. But at the same time, our awareness in this space has changed over time. I don't think it's irresponsible of us to expect awards to do the same.
I absolutely agree. And I think that's one of the things that escape artists obviously seems to be doing really well in terms of not just your staff, which is one of the more diverse staffs that I've seen in terms of a publishing company, but you guys have also made an effort over the last few years to make sure that you're getting narrators with backgrounds that match the stories that you're producing from also a very diverse range of voices. So can you kind of speak to that development in the field and sort of the importance to you guys, to escape artists, to the future of audio podcasting, audio dramas in terms of diversity?
I think it's absolutely central. It's overdue, and we are not doing enough fast enough. One of our core mission statements is everybody gets a place around the fireplace. You know, stories are one of the oldest forms of human interaction. It's a cornerstone of culture, and everybody needs to have that place to be equal and to have the opportunity to tell their story from their experience. The true magic of audio fiction, as I describe it, is the pairing of the voice and the text. Because there's lots of fiction out there that is narrated by the same person month or week after week, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it is magic, and it takes a text to an entirely different level of interaction when you have the right voice. And more our listeners, our writers, our consumers, our fans have come to an awareness that the right voice is more than just matching a gender with a protagonist.
Yeah.
It is, can this person speak a language in an idiomatic dialect, not just an affectation? Can this person bring personal experience and therefore emotion to a text? It's part of what we look for in television and in movies. And audio fiction is exactly that, just without the pictures. And so it makes perfect sense that we talk less and less about narrators these days and more about voice actors, because that's exactly what it is. And acting is more than just, you know, being the right demographic category for a protagonist. It is bringing the authenticity of experience. It's bringing the own voice. It's bringing all of that emotion to the text. So it's become a bigger and bigger priority for us. And it is a big hurdle being honest, I know from my own personal experience at Cast of Wonders that we have delayed the release of stories because the voice wasn't right, or we couldn't recruit an authentic voice for a particular story. And we're always really clear with our authors and we communicate about that. And overwhelmingly, the response we receive is, I would rather it went later with the right voice than you just slapped a random narrator on a story. So it's not just our listeners who give us that feedback, it's our authors. And I mean, you don't say no to that. That's what the mandate is.
That's the only reason I don't mind that I've only had a chance to do two narrations for you guys. Like, you don't need any more middle American white women narrating stories.
If it's any consolation, they only tend to wheel me out these days for amiable Cockney or increasingly terrified horror academic.
Two very fantastic roles.
Yeah, however inclusive we all try to be, it's impossible to get things right all the time. And not only that, what is right keeps evolving. And with that in mind, can y'all talk a little bit about what happened with Artemis Rising this year?
Yeah, sure thing. And it's exactly that.
Yeah.
We didn't get it right. So let me give a little bit of listening, a little bit of background for listeners. Artemis Rising is a showcase we run every year. It's on its fifth year this year. Mm-hmm. It was originally started as it had two goals. One, our editors wanted an opportunity to encourage and to be able to point to a submission call that was specifically for, and I'm going to say this here, it's harder to say in text, but non-male authors. And even that is the incorrect wording, and that's one of the things we've learned. But the point was that our editors were feeling very overwhelmed in their submissions piles, that they weren't, that men's stories were all they were receiving, and so they wanted to do something about it. The second component of Artemis Rising we didn't talk about enough, and that was, and this is purely down to Rachel K. Jones and her wonderful kind of shepherding of this movement as it started, it was an opportunity for people within EA's organization to take new roles, to get new experience, to try an editorial task, to try an audio production task if they'd never done it before, in a limited capacity with lots and lots of support. So it had an internal goal and it had an external goal. What we didn't anticipate is how beloved it became over those first 3 or 4 years. Because we had repeat authors and people who told us they were specifically holding stories to submit them for that call, because there was a real sense that people responded well to it and they enjoyed it. There were, of course, trolls. There are always trolls. We got, you know, we always get a lot of, why do you only let women submit to, you know, I'm not even going to go there. They don't deserve the breath. So this last year, we, as a community, the language and the sense of identity and the sense of ownership that different genders and different groups have has really started to come to the forefront of the genre community. And it's changed the language, you're right, very quickly. And also, I'm not going to say inconsistently, but kind of in a, I think of them as archipelagos. There are some communities which have very specific language that they prefer to have used. There are other communities that have or wish to be approached in different ways. The point is there is no genre-wide consensus about any one particular identity. And so as we were trying to evolve our language in this space, we got parts wrong. And that was brought to our attention quite quickly, and we apologized for it, and we adjusted for it, and we're still doing that. We're still learning and evolving in this space. And I think one of the things that we as a community have difficulty with, and this may be my generational experience talking, is we hate failing. We hate getting something wrong.
Yeah.
And the effect of that is that when you are in a liminal vocabulary or identity space where there is no consensus on how to do something, quote, right, unquote, people don't try. It becomes a suppression effect. And therefore, less experimentation and less development and contribution to the development of the language occurs. When we got it wrong, we had a real big talk about, do we keep doing this? Have we poisoned our well, and do we deserve to slink away in shame? And I think the point we came to was that if we don't keep trying and failing and admitting we failed and learning and talking publicly about that process as a way of encouraging and supporting others in doing the same, we're not being true to ourselves and we're not being true to our community. And so we keep going. And we may continue to make mistakes. And there are ways that it's probably going to adjust going forward. There's probably, especially, again, with my Cast of Wonders hat on, especially in the YA space, there's a real pertinent question about whether or not women writing in particular are a marginalized group. I mean, that's a real question for the genre to have. And therefore, Artemis Rising may not be so fit for purpose for that particular show. We don't know really where we're going to go with this next. I mean, the showcase runs next month, starting in March, and it's got a great lineup already. But next year, we're going to have to learn again. And I don't know where that's going to be right now.
Well, I, for one, am glad that the conversation is still happening, because obviously it is a really big conversation. It is also one of the areas that genre doesn't do such a great job of these days, at least in terms of the community, particularly in terms of the podcasting community portion, which tends to be overwhelmingly white, cis, male. And so all of us have to learn sort of together how to move forward with it and get better at what we're doing in terms of representation.
Yeah.
Yes. There are way too many people who appear to be incapable of admitting mistakes, and their strategy when called out on anything is to double down on it. And I think it's unfair to expect perfection of anybody, but it's so important. I think it's definitely a mandatory expectation that people can learn from things and change.
Yeah, because if we don't foster an environment where someone's allowed to say, oh, I screwed that right up, I'm sorry, then what you're telling people, in essence, is don't come here until you get it right. You're providing a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And that disproportionately affects portions of our community. We know that. And those are specifically the people that we need to be encouraging. The other thing I always try to keep in mind is there is no monopoly on the truth here. There may be established voices. There may be people who have experience or identities with more authenticity of lived experience that they're willing to share. But that doesn't mean that they are the one true way. And so there has to be room in the community, not only for discussion of multiple approaches, but also, you know, people have to have a safe space in which to fail, if that makes sense. Not intentionally, not gratuitously, and hopefully not repeatedly, because at that point you have to have a different conversation about whether or not you're being performative. But if we don't allow these conversations to happen, and instead we decide that someone who makes one mistake once in public is going to be ostracized and never talked to again, then our behavior is probably just as bad, if not worse, as the behavior we're condemning. And I think any community has its particular foibles. And if I had one observation to make, it would be that, at least in my experience, this is a community that loves a good shouting match. and I do think that there are times where the emotion and the drama and the energy around an event, again, this is entirely my opinion, far outstrips, I think, the actual events or the impact of them. And my observation is that contributes to a situation where we're not encouraging dialogue, we're not encouraging support, we're not giving this person room to make a mistake and to recover. we're going to name and shame them and kick them out and never let them come back again.
Mm.
I think that's fair. Sort of related to that is the fact that, I mean, you guys are pretty engaged with the science fiction community as a whole, and you're very engaged with your own community, but comments and discussions on your forums have kind of dropped from a few years ago. Are people making up for that, though, in terms of the engagement on in other places? Twitter, Facebook, everywhere else?
In person.
In person. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting question, because like so much of what we're doing, it's kind of an ongoing process. So much so, in fact, that you are the third person from a third perspective who's contacted me in the last week and gone, your forums are really quiet right now, which kind of speaks to a default level of engagement all by itself. It's a strange one because, again, the show we went to a couple of weeks ago, one of the first things that was said was, if you are not on a social media platform, you do not have the full audience you could have, because there are people who will exclusively use that platform who won't have heard of you. And that level of persistent engagement across various platforms is something which we're looking at and looking at expanding into. Facebook, I have to be honest, brings me out in hypes. I think it's a UI designed by someone who hates humans. But we have a lot of measurable success there. The most success we have is on Twitter, and more that success is coming from staff and authors, where because all four shows have such a switched on social media team, they can do two things really well. And the first is engage and hold trolls at range, which two or three times a year is needed. And the second is just the weekly grind of stories coming out. We push each one, and we give people as many opportunities as possible to discover those stories. And just in the last 2-3 weeks even, that's picked up and picked up really noticeably. And that makes me very happy. And again, as Marguerite said, in person, I mean, we've both had the singularly lovely experience at conventions of being voice recognized.
Can I tell you my...
By you, for one.
Can I tell you my favorite story?
Sure.
So WorldCon was in London several years ago, and it's at the Excel Center, which is out
like a mile and a half long.
It's literally, I think, a mile long building out on the eastern side of Canary Wharf, and most of the convention space was at one particular end, and we had gotten off the light rail at the wrong end and had to walk from the far end, and we were with Mer Lafferty, and Mer and Alistair were chatting. And this is a true story. We walked the entire length of that building, and the two of them could not go 50 feet without being stopped. And someone's saying, wait a minute, I recognize that voice. Alistair had this very sweet, she had to be 85 years old, on a walker woman, come up to him and take his hand and go, I love your voice, dearie. And it was just the sweetest thing ever. But I think one of the things we probably should have touched on when we were describing EA is we're deceptively large. There are about 100 people involved with the escape artists around the globe.
Someone who works for us is always awake,
and
basically.
We keep a running calendar of people's convention appearances so that we can get them promotional materials and you know, talk about them on Twitter. I don't think there's a week between now and the end of August where we don't have a person at a convention. That kind of in-person presence has been a much bigger component of what EA has been lately, to the point where, you know, we're starting to talk about, does that mean we need to be doing more live shows? Does that mean we need to kind of switch around our audience engagement? But to come back to the point Alistair was saying, in the podcasting space especially, if you are not on all of the big platforms, you're not capturing all of your audience.
Yeah.
And as an organization, we sit in this really weird space where we're a podcast, which has its own community, which we've never been terribly engaged with before, and that is changing. And we're also a publisher in a genre, which has a community, which we're both incredibly engaged in. But to some extent, we've exhausted the pools of people that we can tap to learn more about us. And when you are an organization that is funded by donations, your audience size needs to be as huge as possible. Because, of course, I think the average organization like NPR or public PBS, they get about a 3% donation rate. 1 to 3% is quite average. And so if you're going to run your entire organization on donations, you have to have as big a pool as possible so that that 1% or that 1 to 3% ratio, which never really changes, has a big potential pool. And so we've been concentrating a lot of effort this last year, especially since the websites were updated, with being on YouTube, being on Spotify, being on Pandora. We were launch titles for several of the big podcast offerings,
including
Google Play, including Shudder Network. As more and more big media companies are starting to move into the space, that's a whole different debate about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But as bigger and bigger players are moving in here, being an older established name with bigger audiences gives us early access to those audiences. And it's kind of, it has to be within our best interest to bring ourselves to those audiences to try and capture that larger slice of the 1 to 3%.
And it's been particularly interesting to see it pick up across the last couple of years, because going back to LungCon in 2014, we went as attendees. We weren't on any panels.
And I think I bought a day badge.
I think you did. And we sat in the audience for a panel on podcasting and listened to the editorial teams of four high-end magazines. And I swear this is a direct quote. One of them was asked about podcasting. They went, yeah, we just ripped off Escape Pod. And then the one next to them went, really? Because we just ripped you off. And I know it sounds like I'm making this up, but this is word for word what was said.
All four of them did.
All four of them. It gets to the Q&A. And I, who at this point am going, should I feel bad about this or weirdly proud? I'm going to be weirdly proud. Stood up, asked a question, went, hi, first off, I'm Escape Pod. And they were like, yes! And the really strange thing is it's felt from an engagement point of view. And some of this is my own fundamental lack of confidence in my personal career as opposed to the podcasting career. It's felt
Sorry.
It's felt from an engagement point of view like we've been starting from three steps back, because we started before most other people did.
Yeah.
And very slowly, but very definitively, that's changing now. And it's really nice to see.
It's this kind of double-edged sword of being a staple in the environment for so long that it's great to be taken for granted, because, I mean, being honest, we have one of the biggest audiences in genre podcasting. We have 500,000 listeners a month between the four shows. It's huge. But at the same time, so much of the focus in our genre is on the new. And because reprints are so near and dear to our hearts and so key to our mission statement, there's less opportunity to be recognized for the new. And so you're faced with this kind of cognitive disconnect between being huge and well-established and everywhere. And yet when it comes to the prestigious stuff we all talk about, I mean, we do an internal staff survey every year, and we always ask people, what does success look like? If we were to be the coolest thing you could ever think of, what it would be? And it's always Hugo, Nebula, World Fantasy, Hugo. And we are just now starting to edge into that space where we have to go, holy crap, we were a Hugo nominee next year, and World Fantasy, and we won horror awards in the UK and Canada and Australia. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to start adjusting your expectations. And it's nice, but it's kind of also not the point, if that makes sense.
And also, again, because, hello, British, you always, and by you I mean me, are perennially terrified of realizing how well you're doing, slipping over into entitlement. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a white guy. As Scalzi said, the universe is set on its lowest difficulty setting for me. And somehow along the way, I've interpreted that into, you must never want things. Ever. Wanting things is bad. And it's really difficult to sometimes for me to kind of find the sweet spot in the middle between going, yeah, we're doing all right, and am I being arrogant? And a lot of the time, that means I don't say anything.
And I think it goes back to one of the points you made earlier about having a really diverse team and striving always to have a diverse team is a real strength here.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's no one, nothing in EA is an individual effort. Nothing. It is all groups of people giving of themselves and you know, plotting a course and having a voice and having a mission and wanting to do certain things. And so when an accomplishment or a nomination comes in, it's a huge group of people who all deserve the recognition. Yeah. It's never one person. I know that doesn't help your particular, you know, I'm British, I can't write one nice things. But yes, you can want nice things. Mm. It's just, I think we both struggle a lot with that disconnect between, well, do I want nice things? I could, you know, let me phrase it this way. I think there are two things you can do in a creative endeavor, whatever an endeavor it is. You can do your thing and do it the best you can, or you can chase recognition and the popular thing and the awards thing. And there are two different goals and two different skill sets. And I think at some point, everybody has to pick.
Right.
Whether they want to be the hot popular thing and that's what they're going to devote their time to. And that's how their social campaigns are oriented. And that's what drives like what conventions they go to or, you know, what relationships they want to foster. Or you can be a person who's like, you know what? This is my thing and I love my thing and I'm going to polish my thing and make it the best it is. And it's not for everybody and that's okay. Now, we tend towards that side of things, but that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt come nomination season where it's like, oh, look, there's the list of the top 50 recommended stories. They don't know we exist.
Right.
I share this experience with like E. Catherine Tobler from yes. Shimmer. We always, we always commiserate on, oh, look, there's the top 50 short stories, and I see 5 publications.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not a slam on those publications.
No, because, of course I mean, not.
The thing which always seems to be really assumed, and I feel should be said out loud, is there is a ridiculous amount of brilliant work out there at the moment. But that's great. And sometimes that's also a problem.
Yeah. One of our, talking about engagement, one of our big goals this year is we need to help encourage and foster more reviewers in the audio fiction space. There are very few of them. They are devoted and we love them and we thank them so much for all of their work. But we need to help them. And we're talking about technical ways we can do that, whether that's tweaks we can make to our website. We want to start creating ebooks so that more traditional annual anthology reviewers can learn we exist. Things like that. Other ways of engaging with the great stuff that we're already doing, but maybe we're not making it as easy for editors and reviewers as it could be.
And so much of this is strangely, another extrusion of the exact process we've talked about almost all the time here. This process is constantly a matter of tuning. It's constantly a matter of finding an area where we don't know something and learning it, or trying something new, or learning how to do something better, or pushing outside our comfort zone.
It's also totally a stumbling of the medium we publish in. Reviewers will not accept audio. We had to push to get the audio in the Hugo packet last year for Escape Pod. We got some resistance for that. And we're like, no, we will put you together an ebook, but we are also making the files available. And that was very important to us.
It's part of who you are.
Yeah.
Precisely.
And thank you for basically answering a question that I had, which was, obviously, you guys are trying to encourage more voices to engage in the audio fiction market. How can listeners do that? How can we all do that? Promote audio fiction, the short fiction market in general? What are ways that can make it easier for people to engage that you guys are working on doing?
I get to do a version of this spiel on average once a week into a microphone in our high-tech airing cupboard recording studio. The most important thing, I know I sound a little bit like a broken record, is social media. With my journalist hat on, my entire career is powered by enthusiasm. My job is to go out and find things and put them in front of people and go, this is great, here's why. Or the third act here is really shonky, but the rest of it's great, here's why. And I think the more people do that, the more people open themselves up to the possibility of enthusiasm and of enjoying something and of signal boosting the thing they're enjoying, the better everyone's social media experience becomes and the more every single boat gets lifted. Mm-hmm. And every week when I do the end cap for Pseudopod, I say, if you like this story, talk about it. Link to it on Facebook, link to it on... I've got like 15 LinkedIn friends of going, link to it on LinkedIn, and people have gone, well, here I am. on Twitter, blog about it, talk about it on your own podcast. We are, and I'm dangerously close to going all High School Musical here, but we really are all in this together. Mm. And there isn't a problem, whether that problem is a mechanical conundrum that needs to be solved, or an emotion that needs to be embraced or salved, that someone else out there can't help you with, or another piece of art can't help you with.
Yeah, and I think it's that piece of art point that's really important. Cast of Wonders specifically has always been edited from the perspective that this is designed for the school run. This is the 30 minutes where you have a parent and children in the car, have a story, everybody gets something out of it. It's the Pixar approach. And it's that car point that's important. We get email regularly from people who work in construction, who sit in big construction equipment, tower cranes, 8-10 hours a day, who love our content because that's when they listen. People who talk about exercising, people in hospitals, people in commutes, people in break rooms. One of the nice things about audio is it is a very, very accessible way to add fiction to your life. And I think we all have this kind of image of what a podcast is. It's three guys around a mic yelling at each other about politics for 45 minutes. And if you can get past that stereotype, there are so many ways that you can incorporate it into your life. And every opportunity you talk to somebody about, so what did you do today? You can say, well, I listened to this great short story. You know, from my perspective, we're being a little more targeted about engagement, and it's the reviewer community. I would specifically like to engage in more because I think they do such a wonderful job of synthesizing kind of trends and moods in stories, and they do it in a very engaging and condensed way that seems to really put its thumb on the pulse of our community. And I really like how, I hate the phrase tastemaker, but I really like how they speak from kind of positions of experience and authority. They're trusted, just like you trust a specific journalist or a specific news reporter. You develop a rapport and you trust a specific reporter. And I think if we could do more to make those people and other publications that do their kind of work aware of our existence, it would help. And so much of that in the past has been, one, an awareness exercise, and two, no reviewer out there in the world will let me send them audio files. And so that's a technical gap we've been trying to, to encourage. Part of it's through social media, but also part of it is through, hey, look, here's a link. Our text is right there.
Yeah.
It, even just myth busting that particular piece that, well, you only publish in audio. No. We publish in both. And we get emails every week from non-native English speakers who say, thank you. I can practice my English because I can read your story and I can listen to someone speak it at the same time. And that is an incredible tool for us.
So, Trish, get on that, okay? That's your new job. You don't get to be editor anymore. You're just going to be our audio fiction reviewer from now on. So I'm reassigning you.
I will see if I can partition some time for that.
Part of the problem is, I mean, some of the really big outlets don't know podcasts exist.
Yeah.
Why aren't there monthly podcast review columns in all the places where we get monthly reviews of short fiction or, you know, coming titles in long fiction?
Yeah.
Why aren't people saying, here's the latest three episodes from these audio dramas. Here's the latest three fiction, you know, audio fiction releases at these three outlets. We don't have that, and that's a problem.
One of the newspapers I work for has a weekly tech and media page that does have a podcast roundup that we get from a syndicate.
There's you, and there's the first editor who ever gave me a job, who moved out to the Canary Islands a decade ago, and has remained a tech journalist and also edits the Canary Islands newspaper.
All that Canary Island tech,
And podcasting. He does a massive podcast column every month.
Yeah, it can be done. Yeah. I just don't know why it isn't done more.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, podcasts are always the subject of jokes. I mean, there's a joke about it in one of the latest Good Place episodes. They're obviously pervading our culture to the point where people make jokes about them. So why aren't we engaging with them critically in our media and on our reviews in such a way that more people can learn more about them?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting just recently finding out that podcasting as an overall market is still so tiny in terms of the market pool, because it's something like $315 million dollar market, which is small potatoes when you compare it to anything else. And I'm still sitting here going, though, but there's so many of us. How is that possible?
Yeah, I think I read 44% of Americans have listened to a podcast in the last year. So, you know, they may not be sticking with them and they may not be giving any advertising revenue.
Right.
But, you know, definitely a growing it's a wide audience out there.
I can connect those two dots. One of the big misconceptions of, again, I think it's a generational thing, is if it's digital, it must be free.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this disconnect between spending money on the consumption of a digital product and therefore traditional economic processes like advertisers, like companies that do valuations, do not connect with podcasting because it's just seen as this kind of free thing that people do. I mean, I can recognize the economic potential of a media company, but they don't recognize the economic potential of a radio show.
And I mean, there's an example of that you can pull from headlines last week when Spotify bought Gimlet and Anchor. They bought a very well-known podcasting company, and they bought a distribution platform. And the corporate thinking there is transparent. It's them going, we need to be doing this more because lots of people are downloading podcasts on Spotify. We need somewhere to put them. This plus this.
Yeah, you know? Very traditional, very corporate model. It was a huge topic of conversation at Pod UK, the first UK podcasting convention that we just went to, this growing divide between what's seen as the indie scene, of which we are a part, and the corporate scene, which are ex-NPR people with access to professional level equipment and sound producers producing for, you know, very different purposes. One of the huge concerns about the Gimlet purchase is, okay, that means it's all going to go pay to play, isn't it? We're going to lose all of that content, we being people who listen to it, because it'll be paywalled. And the podcasting community is really having a conversation about coming to a view that, no, we don't accept that. We don't accept that there's going to be this big corporate versus indie division. We don't accept that we're going to be a community that has rock stars. So the week before Pod UK happened, and this is a bit of a tangent from a genre perspective, I apologize, PodCon happened in the U.S. Now, PodCon was on its second year. It had been Indiegogo funded the previous year. It took place in Seattle in January. And one of the big complaints to emerge from the show was that three or four well-established titles were given the majority of all the programming. And it had started to cause this stratification system where you had rock stars and you had, quote, just everybody else. And the following week, Pod UK, there was a lot of discussion about, well, we don't want that. We don't want there to be rock stars. We are a creative community. We are all peers. We want to lock arms and rise together and have and develop an environment where all of us can do more of what it is we love. And to do that, well, first of all, we'll all go talk to the BBC because this is the UK and that's where all of the funding comes from for these sorts of things. But it's as a young creative community, it's really interesting to see that it's taking what I would consider a very principled, conscious stand at a very young age to avoid the sort of stratifications that we see leading to the kind of commercial divide in mainstream podcasting.
That's really interesting because after the Spotify purchase, I was starting to think of things, ways that the podcasting community could be, you know, supported and also still be free to listen to and whatnot. And the only conclusion I could come to was that, honestly, Twitch seems like the best model right now in terms of how they have subscriptions. You can still obviously participate without the subscription, but the subscription basically, you know, allows the streamer to be better supported, to have the Twitch partnerships and things like that. Because in seeking a model for this type of thing to work, there's not a lot out there that I can see at the corporate level. Obviously, iTunes has had no support. They basically are just like, here, have a place to put your podcast feed, and then done.
Oh, and we're only ever going to sponsor or highlight, of course, you know, the same 15 shows over and over again.
Exactly, exactly. And so it's going to be interesting to see and to watch where the entire podcasting community goes at the corporate level, especially now that, you know, capitalists are like, oh, there's a thing that we might be able to make money on.
Oh, look. Hey, did you know that people read fiction into microphones and they put it on the internet? We set the clock!
Exactly.
This has been a fascinating discussion. I guess to wrap things up on a lighter note, the last few months I've been catching up on the New Century Multiverse, and I was listening to the Tiger's Eye audiobook, and hey, that civil rights lion lawyer sounds very familiar. I would like to hear about some of the non-EA side projects or whatever that you two may have been working on. Alistair, I know you've been working on kickstarting a game, right?
Yeah, that actually kickstarted just towards the end of last year, and we did really, really well. We I think had 9 stretch goals, and we hit 7 of them.
Cool.
Which is great because it gave me more stuff to do. After the War is something which is very dear to my heart, and it actually came about as a result of Escape Artists. Jason Peter, the game designer, approached me and went, "You seem to know a lot about horror. We should talk." And we knocked an idea around, and it turned into this. And the shortest possible version is this: it's set after a catastrophic galaxy-wide war with a piece of sentient alien music. And it's set on basically the first colony or the last colony, depending on your point of view, to put itself back together. And it's a game which emphasizes community building and horror and science fiction. And I have rarely had more fun designing tabletop RPG stuff than I have with Magnus. There is a joke which went into one of the early alien race descriptions, which still makes me laugh 2 years later, because it's still in there. So I'm working on that at the moment. I am, after a considerable period of time away from it, writing fiction again. I did NaNoWriMo for the first time in about 8 years last year, and I have a horrible first draft, as you have to have, and I'm in the process of knocking that into shape. I also have a novella idea, which I'm putting together, which is about my all-time favorite ridiculous piece of British law. And I can say nothing more about this, because otherwise I'm going to go kind of full Newton Pacific Rim and tell you the whole thing.
But that would be really cool.
But when this comes out, the central idea is something you will not believe is real, and it is.
Yeah.
So there's that, and that's great. And I'm also playing a deeply, deeply terrifying possible human being on the Magnus Archives at the moment, which is amazing because the Magnus Archives is one of my all-time favorite podcasts. This is a show which started about 3 years ago. And the basic premise is it's a paranormal research institute whose new archivist finds to his disgust that his predecessor filed nothing. So he literally just picks a witness statement at random, reads it into a microphone. So it starts off as Tales of the Unexpected. And then about six episodes in, you notice a name that's come up before. And then 12 episodes in, you realize what they're really doing. And I've been a big fan of the show from the start. And last year, I reached out to them and we got chatting. And they have brought me in as a character called Peter Lucas, who is lovely and charming and lovely and charming.
Yeah.
And turns up from time to time. And I love doing that.
Marguerite, do you have any projects or interests that you want to tell us about, aside from EA?
I am desperately trying to carve the space in my schedule at this point to move into anthology editing. Mm. I have one that I have struggled to get off the ground just because of my existing commitments, but we hope to kickstart it this spring, or perhaps even early summer at this point, that I'm working on with Mer Lafferty. I have a second idea already lined up. That's the big one on the fiction mm-hmm. front at that point. A lot of my time and energy right now is actually focused on, okay, this sounds weird, but I have a particular skill which is not very common in my experience in genre community. I speak committee. And I didn't put my hand down fast enough, and Alex Axe pulled a great maneuver on me at the last...
Alex straight up Aikido'd you.
Yeah, very
Alex
much so.
Is very good at that, so...
Yes, and so I am now involved with a committee for the World Science Fiction Society. I am now involved in the SFWA Short Fiction Committee, because I wanted to make sure that there was a voice not only from an audio perspective, but from a publisher's perspective, I think, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of tendency for organizations which advocate for authors quite logically to be made up of entirely authors. And I think bringing a little bit of wider perspective to a field can help. And we're also involved here in the UK. We run the group of volunteers for FantasyCon every year, which is how we became legends, apparently. And so, yeah, a lot of my, I say spare time, but let's just say time, is in community engagement. So stuff around genre and supportive genre that isn't actually writing. I'm a lawyer by trade, and so I write contracts all day long, but that's a very different type of writing.
That sounds fantastic. I'm looking forward to everything that you guys are working on.
Thank you.
Let's get some notes in the links in the show notes, yes, right, Jen?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, there will be lots of show notes. Really looking forward to writing that. Why do you guys have so much going on? It's just going to be... I tease.
We stay busy.
Clearly. So before we close out, give us your deets. Give us where people can find you, where they can find all of the Escape Artist podcasts and everything else that you're doing.
That sounds good. I'll go first to save poor Alistair's very Krogan voice at the moment. Escapeartist.net, or EA Prime, as we call it, is the main website. You can get to all of our shows from there. Escape Pod for science fiction, Pseudopod for horror, Podcastle for fantasy, and Cast of Wonders for young adult fiction. I edit Cast of Wonders, and my very delayed staff pick is hopefully going to go live quite soon, if not within the hour. I technically have a website in my name, but that's mostly so other people don't poach it. I'm not an active blogger. If best place for social engagement for me is on, to my shame, Twitter, where I am at Legal Valkyrie.
And you can find me in a couple of different places. I write for a wide variety of people. I think most commonly at Sci-Fi Bulletin at the moment. My Twitter is at Alistair Stewart. My blog is alistairstewart.com. And when you go to my blog, a very, very tasteful sign-up box will appear for The Full Lid, which is my weekly newsletter. I've been doing this for about 15 months now, and it's basically Fridays at 5 p.m., you will get about 2,500 words from me of stuff I've really liked in the last week. Movies, games, comics, anything like that. Other people's writing, which I found that I've enjoyed. And it's designed specifically to give you something fun and relaxing to read at the end of your working week.
We should also probably say that depending on when this episode goes live, it is Hugo nomination season. And so we should give you those sorts of details as well. All four of the Escape Artist podcasts are semi-pro zines under the Hugo nomination category. Our editorial teams are all eligible in the short form editor categories, and they do prefer to be nominated as teams.
And I'm eligible as best fan writer. And there is a post on my blog, which I'll forward to you for the show notes, detailing my eligible work.
And EA Prime has a full roundup of all of our eligibility, including all the eligibility posts for members of the EA family.
Fantastic. That sounds nice and tightly wrapped up for me to give to our listeners. Yay! I love when that happens.
I love it when a plan comes together.
Exactly. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the show today. We really, really appreciate it. And thank you, Trish, for being like, they must come on the show.
It's been a lovely discussion. So interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, folks, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty or find us on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, our webpage skiffyandfanty.com, or you can even send us an email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. The intro music for this podcast was taken from Rock Thing by Creo. You can find out more about their music on freemusicarchive.org.